The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Please join me in a warm Philadelphia welcome for Gabrielle Union. The book, as you already know, is called We're Going to Need More Wine. There are some amazing stories in here. And Gabrielle, as I read your book, what struck me the most was your gut-level honesty. You talk about everything from race to rape to infertility to what you perceive to be your own flaws. And I wondered, as I read it, where did you gather the courage to be so transparent in this book?
I talk a lot about therapy. I've always talked about therapy because it gave me hope. It gave me the tools to put one foot in front of the other. As I often say, which is a bizarre thing to say, is that I had the luxury of being raped in an affluent community with an underworked police department and an underutilized rape crisis center. My workman's comp kicked right in. I was immediately put into therapy. Immediately, my parents said, this is bigger than us. You need professional help. So while I still had two black eyes, my face was swollen beyond recognition, I went to my first therapy session and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress syndrome, which I've been dealing with for literally 25 years. This July was the 25th anniversary of my rape. So I've been in therapy for 25 years, unapologetically. I recognized that I was a victim, but I didn't want to stay there. I wanted to be a survivor. And as life has happened, I have felt victimized at different times for different reasons. But I never wanted to stay there. I always wanted to be a survivor of whatever adversity I'd been experiencing. And through therapy, finally, I'll be 45 in 2 weeks, I finally felt peace. Now you gotta applaud my lower back pain and my wonky hip too now. But it took literally 44 years for me to realize that I had worth from birth. And I finally found the courage last year to write my story, to even believe that I had value, that my words had value, that I was talented enough of a writer to release these words to the public. I had enough therapy to know that, okay, I can write these words and I can speak eloquently and effectively in front of people and to the press about these stories. That's where I found the courage, in therapy. I strongly recommend it.
As the Harvey Weinstein story has been unfolding, I thought about you and wondered how you're processing all of that.
What I see when I look at the enormity of the Harvey Weinstein scandal, I don't even think scandal is a big enough word, is Harvey Weinstein is one man. Sexual violence, sexual harassment is pervasive in our global culture. It is everywhere. It is not limited to Hollywood. There are millions of Harvey Weinsteins. And every person who has suffered at the hands of a predator, whether that's in the office, in the pulpit, in your home, in your community, your pain is real, and I believe you. Now, what I saw with Harvey Weinstein is there was a woman that came forward in the early 80s. And there were dozens over the years who told people. Not everyone was silent. We just collectively, as a society, decided that those women were too ambitious. They went to the hotel room. They should have known. Well, what did they have on? They were young. They were trying to get ahead. We made up all these excuses why we shouldn't believe them, why their pain was not real and valid. And it literally took Hollywood royalty to be preyed on, the audacity to prey on Hollywood royalty for us as a society to collectively decide that their pain was intolerable. Now, if you were the first woman in the early 80s who came forward, you gotta be like, so my pain ain't shit. And every woman from the early 80s to now who wasn't believed, who was cast aside, who, you know, the people who turned a blind eye. And we're talking about Harvey, but I'm really talking about this that goes on literally across our global community. No one in this room is innocent either. We have all seen sexual harassment, whether that's been on the street, in by way of catcalls, in our offices, in our homes, in our churches, in our communities. We've all seen it. We've all heard about it. And we didn't do anything because that's not my business. That's that man's problem. Well, just don't go near Uncle So-and-so. Mm-hmm. Not Uncle So-and-so is no longer invited ever. But you got to figure out how to work around him. Or the aunt that gives lingering, wet, slobbery kisses that we decide is cute, but makes our kids uncomfortable. Don't act uppity. Give your aunt some sugar. Oh. We're not listening to our kids, we're not listening to women, we're not listening to men. When Terry Crews can come out and say that a Hollywood executive literally grabbed his penis in front of his wife, at a party in front of witnesses, and people still felt that he should have felt somehow lucky that he was getting attention. It is so pervasive, but this idea that if you're just a good enough Christian, that if you're just a good enough inter-ex religion here, if you just dress modestly, if you just don't go to that party or to that hotel room, or if you just layer up, if you just don't drink, if you just do this, sexual violence, sexual harassment can happen to anyone at any time, anywhere. And if you don't drive that home again and again and again, you are doing yourselves and your loved ones a disservice. I was raped by a stranger at gunpoint while I was at work in a tunic and leggings. Yeah. I was a good girl, straight A's, captain of every sports team. I had a job. I had a two-parent household. Raped. So when I look at my mentions and people were like, I had a snowsuit on. I was six. I was coming from church in my church hat and my pious dress that covered every inch of my body. I was 17. I was coming from work at a hospital in my scrubs. I was 57. Yeah. Rape can happen to anyone, anywhere, at any time.
It's no respecter of persons.
None. Yeah. So when we look at Harvey Weinstein, let's not try to figure out excuses for rape culture and figure out ways of how can I blame the victim? How can I blame and shame them? But instead say, I get it, and I believe you, and let's do better collectively. This is now is the time where we need to see a cultural shift. Is Harvey Weinstein going to be just the tip of the iceberg and it melts away? Or are we going to reveal the whole iceberg that brought down the Titanic? And now is the moment for us to shift. Now, again, if you were that woman from the early 80s, you're like, really? If you were the woman from the dawn of time, or anyone from an oppressed group from the dawn of time whose pain has been categorically and systematically ignored, you're like, really? But better today than never. Yeah.
Another subject that you spend a lot of time talking about in the book is race. In fact, you open the book with a quote from W.E.B. Du Bois talking about, it was from The Souls of Black Folk, talking about the two warring ideals in one dark body and that double consciousness that is required of black people to survive. You experienced that growing up, and you give some amazing examples in the book. Can you share a little bit about how that played out back into your childhood even?
Now, y'all, my childhood, I grew up originally, I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, and my parents got transferred to the Bay Area to a town called Pleasanton. It's exactly how it sounds. We were the chips in the cookie. My family, you know, we all have nicknames. Nobody in my family calls me any derivative of Gabrielle. Nobody calls me Gab, nobody calls me Gabby. They call me Nikki. It's us, it's our people. I didn't know TT's name for 35 years, so I, you know. It's our people.
It's how we do.
It's how we do. But I was so thoroughly committed to assimilating. I did not want to be othered. I wanted to fit in. So I made sure I spoke the Queen's English. I made sure to not be like those other blacks in a world away called Oakland. Like it was like Narnia. Like, but when my classmates and their parents would say, "Oh, you're not like other black people. You know, there's niggers and then there's black people. You're like a good black person," I'd be like, "Great! I know, right?" I was so thoroughly committed to my own silence, my own impotence. You know, in the book I say assimilation is just a journey towards being invisible and complacent in your own oppression. And I was firmly committed to it. You know, back in the day, I don't know if you guys remember, Eddie Murphy used to do this bit about buckwheat. And he'd go, "Ooh, hey," and he'd wear the big, you know, afro, you know. And I don't know if y'all ever had a sleepover with non-black people. When you're firmly committed to not being othered, and you know, at home you wrap your hair, but you can't wrap your hair and not be othered. So you try to sleep pretty, like. So, you know, here I am trying to sleep casket pretty. So my hair don't move. And I'd wake up in the morning and I had no idea what I look like. And they go, "Oh my God, you look just like buckwheat. Do buckwheat." And I did buckwheat. I did it. "Do the Cupid doll." Remember those pencils? I did the Cupid doll too. When there was one other black student that moved into Pleasanton from Oakland, I was like, "We can't be friends. Then they'll know I'm black. Good luck, girl." There was no sisterhood. I was like, there's only room for one happy Negro, and it's me. Cut to, I would be sent back to Omaha from 8 to 18, which is bizarre to say. My parents sent me back to Omaha to learn how to be around black people. Because I talk back to my parents one too many times, like my white friends. So in Omaha, on the north side of Omaha, is all black. It's the home of Malcolm X, where Malcolm X was born. We have the largest black family in the state of Nebraska, which I get it, it's not that hard to be the biggest black family in the state of Nebraska, but we take it with a lot of pride. But during those summers, I was finally seen. I wasn't Black Nikki, which I didn't realize they were calling me. I was just Nikki, the mildly corny cousin from California who did not know any gang members or what BET was. What is this? What is this with all these music videos? Who are these people? I thought Donnie Simpson, y'all, was the finest man ever. Like, summers with Donnie Simpson, my one true love. Donnie, then Ralph Tresvant. Like, that's what I look forward to. Because I could finally be seen. I finally counted, and I wasn't othered. And I had a gang of people that looked like me that would fight you if you said I was corny one too many times. But I was at home. And at the end of the summer, especially as I got older, the re-entry period back to Pleasanton became tougher and tougher. And I hated having to be the good, happy Negro back in Pleasanton that hated doing buckwheat, that grew to resent my best friend's silence in the face of racism from their own parents. I hated their silence. To this day, I hate and resent their silence. That dual consciousness, though, is what prepares me to go then do an episode of Friends after being on City of Angels. When they're like, Nikki, or Gabby, do you know what a mark is? Yeah. I'm an actor. Didn't have to audition for this job because I was just on a hit show on CBS. But the man talked to me in sing-song voice for the whole week. But I'd been there. Do buckwheat. We love it when you entertain us. That's when we're most comfortable. Assimilate, disappear, be complacent. Where you're nice and safe. So, to this day, that code switching that we all have to do, that is exhausting. Where you're literally plotting someone's demise. Like, still to this day. Yeah. When I'm doing Nala, right? My job, Disney Junior, you know, easy gig. I don't even have to get dressed. I literally roll sweats. I'm like, ah. And I have to warn Kyan, my little cub, about a gorge that's coming up that he may fall in, whatever. And the line is, you know, Kyan, look out below. Kyan, look out below. Oh, whoa. Sounds like you're gonna hit him with a hairbrush. I mean, no, just, you know, like, you love your son. You know, you're just warning him. Okay, Kyan, look out below. Wow, still so angry. Oh, gosh. Kyan, look out. Look out. I don't know. Sure. Perfect.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of sons, you and Dwayne Wade.
Yeah.
Are raising three young black men in your house, his sons and his nephew. Tell us a little bit about how you navigate raising three young black boys in the climate in which we live. What is that like, and how do you do it?
Terrifying. I mean, living in Florida, stand your ground state, open carry state. We have privileged black boys with a lot of privileged white friends. And they want to be able to enjoy all of the privilege that comes from D-Wade and Gab, our careers, the wealth that we have accumulated. They want to be able to act like they're spoiled little friends. They want to be able to question a teacher when she misspeaks. They want to be able to get in a scuffle in the hallway and be called assertive. They want to be able to question authority figures like police officers because they know their rights. They want to have the luxury of being proud. And I have to explain, no, you can't do the drive-by dunk challenge on this street that Phil Collins lives on and one of the remaining Bee Gees. I don't know which one, though. It's the one that's left. Because now you're trespassing, and you've just given them free license to murder you.
It's one of those black bombs.
It's one of
the
black truth bombs.
Yeah.
But what they don't understand is, even if you never trespass, all our neighbors or a police officer has to say is, I felt threatened. Don't have to be armed. Sandra Bland was armed with her voice and her passion and knowing her rights. Dead. Tamir Rice, playing 12, playing with a toy gun in an open carry state, so even if it was a real gun, it's his effing right. And in less than 2 seconds, he was deemed threatening. He's a child. So my boys, who are so excited about hopefully being taller than my husband, I'm secretly hoping they shrink and somehow look less threatening. Your blackness has been weaponized and demonized from birth. And what do you say? Don't exist. Don't go outside. Don't walk the dog. The fact that I even had to give them a lesson on how to walk the dog without looking like you're concealing anything. It's walking a damn dog. When they see my husband getting to move through Miami as D. Wade, Wade County, they're like, I'm Z. Wade. Not without D. Wade, you're just a scary black child. Understand how the world sees you. Understand that no matter what kind of tone that you speak in, no matter how soothing or accurate the facts that you are speaking, you are still going to be seen as very threatening, and you're going to make people feel very unsafe. I feel unsafe. And that's still going to be licensed to murder you. Yeah. So good luck. Yeah. I still need an A on that algebra test. And that's what it's like raising black boys in the state of California, or Florida.
Another subject that you are very transparent about is infertility.
Yeah.
And we've seen that storyline play out on the show as well. You state rather matter-of-factly that you've had 8 or 9 miscarriages. You talk about multiple IVF treatments. How is it, Gabrielle, that you are able to remain encouraged? What would you say to the many women who are struggling with this as well, about how you're able to keep going in the face of the toll, physically and emotionally, that can take?
I stay hopeful because I can feel her spirit. And I say her because that's what it feels like. She's around me. So however and whenever she arrives, we will embrace her, and she's going to be amazing. But we've gone through this process along with a number of other couples. And out of all of the couples, there's about 10, 12. Youngest couple being early 20s, oldest being mid 40s, but most being in the late 20s, early 30s category. A, it made me realize that infertility is not a curse bestowed upon career women who've opted to, you know, have a career instead of starting a family right away. It has nothing to do with your relationship with Jesus. It has nothing to do with, and pardon my language because it's a mixed crowd, but this was an actual comment. She's dealing with infertility because of all those dicks. Sir, from your mama's basement in Alabama, what is the dick threshold that then leads to infertility? Is that, can you cite your source on that one? It's not due to infertility, or it's not due to promiscuity or whatever. There's a lot of misinformation. And infertility, multiple miscarriages, one miscarriage even, is something that people deal with at all ages. And it is devastating. I say 8 or 9 because after a certain point I lost track. The first one was, I was going to say like a death, but it is a death. And we're still mourning that. And you know, we always talk about how miscarriages affect women because we are the vessel. I was not prepared for my husband's reaction. See, like when we learned about the infertility journey from all these couples that we were, you know, we became a part of this very secretive club that nobody wanted anyone else to know about. Only half of those marriages survived. Whether at the end of their journey there was a live birth or not. Because of the toll that it takes emotionally and physically. So we learned what to do and what not to do and how to ensure that our relationship survives, no matter what the outcome. But somehow I only paid attention to the woman's reaction, and I was not prepared for my husband's pain and how deeply affected, and I don't even feel like affected is the right word, like a soul-crushing death. I mean, it's the only way I can try to describe it. And that he had been so committed to this child from an idea. And there's no support for men. And so as I was in my, you know, I'm experiencing the loss of life as it travels out of my body. My husband is experiencing something equally as profound and real and valid outside the bathroom door. And just, it's just devastating. But we know she's out there. And whatever my path towards my additional motherhood, because I'm already raising children, is just a bonus. You know, it's a bonus. And for everybody out there who's experienced infertility, miscarriages, who know people going through it, it is an intensely personal experience. And when they want you to know, or if they want you to know, they will tell you. So stop asking.
Good advice. So we mentioned that that has been a storyline on the show as well, and we have to talk about Pauletta, a.k.a. Mary Jane.
Yes.
So, 4 seasons, the Facebook page says you're coming back in 2018 for a series finale?
Yes, a 2-hour series finale. The same way we came in, We came in with a two-hour movie. We're going out with a two-hour movie.
Yeah. So, can
I know.
You...
I know. This is the debate that we're having right now. So there's some people who are like, because it's the idea of what does Mary Jane's happily ever after look like? You know, and what I realized through Mary Jane and through my own life that everybody's joy is different. And it all of our paths to happiness and peace and fulfillment don't have to match for them to be real and valid. Obviously, I've had a couple marriages now, and you know, I thought my path in my late 20s was, you know, what joy was supposed to look like. That didn't pan out. And so we all have different ideas of what joy is supposed to look like for Mary Jane. And you know, in my heart, I wanted a wedding, but then, you know, somebody else pitched an idea where you see Mary Jane and then walking down the middle of Fifth Avenue with a baby in one hand and a vibrator in the other, and that is her happiness. And I was like, I mean, I get it. So I don't know how it's going to end up, but you will definitely get some resolution for all of the characters that the audience has come to know and love. So, well, we do wish it was more, but 50 Cent said no. So.
So we'll leave it there. So, Gabrielle, before we open it up for our audience questions,
yes.
I would love to have you read a passage from your book for us. We'd love to hear it in your own voice. We talked about this a little bit backstage, so it's already yes. marked out for you, and maybe you'll want to set the scene a little bit about what it is. But
So this is an excerpt from the book where I talk about sort of finding my value and while at the same time really beginning to understand that dual consciousness that Dubois, I know people get really annoyed about how people pronounce that, so I'm going to say it both ways, Dubois, whatever, you know what I'm talking about, that dual consciousness that he speaks of. When I was 15, Kelly, that's my sister, took me to a black frat party at San Jose State. It was like she gave me the keys to this kingdom of cool black people who valued education and fun. They were just worldly and cool and dope and sexy in a way that Omaha gave me an outlet for my Pleasanton frustration. My sister's world of college became a new outlet. I looked around at these students and saw black excellence. I met an Alpha Phi Alpha brother named Daryl who talked to me for a long time that night. He even gave me his number. I gave him a fake number in return because I had lied about my age and this was a man. But I held on to that piece of paper for years. That night made me see the either or schism that I was trapped in between Pleasanton and Omaha. I was caught in a dual consciousness. Who I had to be when I was around my own people and who I had to be in high school. Now, it's easy to see how caught I was in that back and forth mental chess match of trying to be okay in both worlds. Two warring ideals in one dark body, as Dubois wrote. The dark body of a young girl. Each was me, but the constant code switching, changing my language, demeanor, and identity expression to fit in left me exhausted. You were fly, dope, and amazing from birth, I would tell that girl now. From the second you took your first breath, you were worthwhile and valid. And I'm sorry you had to wait so long to learn that for yourself. Now, who's got questions?
Yeah, so on that inspirational note, we do have some people who are helping us with Q&A tonight. They've got microphones, so if you would just raise your hand, we will get someone with a microphone to you, and you can ask your question for Gabrielle.
Okay.
So let's see. It looks like we've got a few over this way.
Hi, Gabrielle.
How are you?
Thanks for chatting.
Ah, I see you. New York and Company.
My question is, now that you have a phone line with New York and Company, and you're always working out your body on Instagram and showing us different tips, do you think that you get a workout line?
You know, I don't, that wasn't anything that I had, you know, had been thinking about. There's so many of my own friends who have dope workout lines. I love Demi Lovato's. But yeah, no, I hadn't thought about it, but I am not opposed to expanding the brand. But right now I'm just really focused on the New York and Company line. But we'll see. I'm not opposed to expanding. But thank you for the suggestion. But I strongly suggest Demi's line supports our Latinx folks.
Hi, Ariel.
Hi.
Nice to have you here in Philadelphia.
Thank you.
I just have a question. You just broke my heart when you said everything will be ending. But what are you going to be doing next?
What am I not doing? So I don't know if you guys heard, but I partnered with David E. Talbert, who was director of Almost Christmas. And this guy, you guys might know him, LeBron James. And we just sold a show to ABC called White Dave. A show about, it's a coming of age story. It's actually David E. Talbert's real life story of, it's like a reverse Fresh Prince, where he goes from an affluent community in Silver Spring, Maryland to Capitol Heights, Maryland. And where that transformation of that, again, that dual consciousness that we are exploring, where this child goes from this community where they do not see the humanity of black people, him included. And the self-hatred is so ingrained in his psyche that when he is abruptly taken out of his world and put into an all-black community, as he sees his own humanity and the humanity of his neighbors, he is then able to be a conduit of change back in Silver Spring, Maryland. And we're super excited about that. I executive produced and starred in a film this summer, a thriller called Breaking In with Will Packer. And then we have this movie called The Public, which is about a very strong librarian as the heroes that they are, that takes place in Cincinnati. Yes. So we're really excited about that. Yeah. And there's another one that we can't announce just yet, but we still have the Flawless line. We're expanding the Flawless hairline. Curly Girls, we're up next. We've got more rollouts for New York and Company throughout the year, so keep looking out for that. We just launched the fall collection yesterday. I've got my Invicta watch line, and we've got Vanilla Pudding, my wine, sold exclusively at Total Wine & More. I feel like I'm forgetting something, but that's what's off the top of my head.
Wow.
Hi, Ariel.
Hi. You can call me Nick. We family now.
Thank you for opening the door for African American brown women. What is your stance on the disparity between skin within the female African American community?
Oh, we cover that in the book. Every time I see team light skin, team dark skin, team mixed chicks, team, you know, XYZ, that is a part of white supremacy that we are buying into. It's the old divide and conquer. And I can't act like I did not feel invisible in the presence of my lighter skin sisters growing up. There was a time I felt like light-skinned girls were put on this earth to torment me and to take my shine and to make me invisible.
Witness over there.
And never once thinking about their humanity and their pain and their struggle and their journey. We're all black people. Now, a lot of us, especially women, get into this place of competition and hatred and there we go. because of who men choose and where the male gaze falls. And it never feels like it falls on us. It never feels like brown-skinned girls' beauty is valued or held up. It always feels like we're the last choice. It always feels like people are preaching to us, love the skin you're in. But it's like, well, okay, I'm there. But ain't nobody choosing me and my high self-esteem over here. I'm not seeing this self-love reflected on the screen. If you think about even commercials and how they're cast, dark-skinned black man, light-skinned black woman, biracial child. Because, and it further reinforces the white supremacy and the Eurocentric standards of beauty that we have bought into. But it's up to us to validate each other, to say we're all pretty, we're all beautiful, we're all smart, we're all talented. And you have to uplift each other. And the divide and conquer is working. It works beautifully. And as long as we can't come together and there's team light skin and team dark skin, we've lost already. They've already won. And we will stay in this place until we liberate ourselves from colorism.
We've got some questions kind of up toward the back, so we don't want to forget the folks who are...
Hi, how are you?
Thank you for coming to Philly. And as someone who is an activist, I'd like to hear your thoughts with regards to the whole Colin Kaepernick situation, the taking of the kneeling, and why he did it, whereas now we see that the person in the current administration and the press want to take it to another ism that has nothing to do with what it's all about.
So I know Cap, and the strength that he has shown, because a lot of people say a lot of things, but when it's time to take the knee, they'd rather lock arms. Because they're thinking about their financial bottom line. But we all talk a lot of shit about what I would do. But it's not your money on the line. It's not your kids' future. So if we could all collectively take a knee, they can't punish everybody. So we don't leave him out there to dry, like, you know, high and dry on his own, having to sue the NFL on his own. Everybody, I really feel like I'm preaching to the choir. Who in here doesn't understand the Colin Kaepernick take a knee? Exactly. So we know it's about police brutality. We know it's about oppression. We know it's about state-sanctioned violence. We know what Black Lives Matter means. It doesn't mean no other lives matter, but the fact that we have to amplify Black lives because we are shown time and time and time and time and time and time again that our lives do not hold the same value. We know what it is. But just like in my mind, how many of us imagined our parents all sat in at Woolworths, that our parents and grandparents were just, everybody was a Black Panther. So I was speaking in DC for the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. It was a commemorative stamp presentation, and I called my parents, and I wanted to know where they were, you know? I mean, did your bus break down en route to D.C.? Could you see Martin Luther King? And I said, Mom, you know, where were you? And she said, well, me and Janet wanted to go down, this is exactly how my mom talks, by the way, me and Janet wanted to go down to the Woolworths in downtown Omaha, and Grandma said no. I was like, Grandma said no. And she said, yeah, Grandma said, if you go down there and protest and somebody from my job sees you or you end up on the news, who's going to feed all these kids? We can't afford to protest. I had kind of saw that going a different way. And then I said, well, did Janet go? She said, Janet went, but they thought she was a white woman. And they served her. So I was like, well, damn, Mom. You know, but that's the reality. You know, a lot of people talk a lot of shit, but when it's time to actually put up or shut up or do something more than tweet or retweet, what are you actually willing to do? Are you really willing to lose your job? Are you willing to lose your status? Are you willing to lose how your community sees you? There's a reason why Martin Luther King was assassinated. There's a reason why Malcolm X was assassinated, Medgar Evers was assassinated. What are you really willing to do? What am I really willing to do? I was like, baby, you and Bron, D. Rose, you get Kevin Love, you get Kyle Korver. Y'all need to take a knee. Like, and my husband's like, no, we're locking arms. And I was like, locking arms is like the, I'm not racist, I've got a black friend of protests. But it's easy to say when I don't have to take a knee. So I applaud Brother Kaepernick. I applaud what his lady is doing. It's weird that I only know her Twitter handle. I'm like, Necessity? But that's not her name. Nessa. I actually don't know. Isn't it weird when you only know people's like IG handles? I'm like, he's got a beautiful girlfriend. And together they are collectively trying to change lives, and I support that wholeheartedly. We actually put our money where our mouths are. We give to organizations that advocate for equality and to fight oppression. So if you can't take a knee, take a knee in other ways. Continue to speak out. Continue to have the difficult conversations. And challenge yourself before we criticize what people are doing or not doing.
So on that, I'm afraid that on that inspiring note, we will have to begin to wrap.
No.
Gabrielle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
She'll be around to sign books, so stick around. Thanks for coming, everyone. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.